Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords. This is the Rental Income Podcast. And now, Dan Lane.
Joining me on the podcast today is Ken Brown, and Ken has a really interesting portfolio. He has many different types of properties. He owns some apartment buildings, he owns some single-family houses in good neighborhoods, and he owns some lower-end properties in rougher neighborhoods. Hey, Ken, welcome to the show. I really specifically want to talk today about the lower-end properties in the rougher neighborhoods. But before we get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in owning rental properties?
Okay. Well, I grew up in New Jersey. I bought my first property when I was 18 and just grew it from there.
That's interesting. 18 years old. Most people at 18, real estate isn't really on their radar yet. What got you interested at such a young age?
Money.
Good answer. Good answer. So tell me about that first deal. How did you find a deal and how did you know what to do at 18?
I didn't really know what to do, but I went down to the courthouse, watched some people do some transactions for a little bit, found a property that was going to foreclosure, talked to the owner, bought it from the owner using a quitclaim deed, got the property resold before the bank could actually foreclose on it. That's how I made my property.
Absolutely incredible. That is great. And then so from there, when did you get into rental properties from there? How long did it take you before you bought your first rental?
My first rental property? I actually probably bought my first rental property in the 90s.
Okay. And was that a lower end property or was that one of your nicer properties?
No, it was a low end property.
Okay. So what attracted you to the low end? Because a lot of times people will say, stay away from the low end properties. It's going to be a lot of headache. It's going to be a lot of hassle. Have you found that to be true, that there's a lot of problems on the lower end?
Well, for people who don't know what they're doing or think that it's going to be easy, yes.
Okay.
You definitely need to have a cast iron stomach.
Okay. Now, would you say that these properties you own, that they're in war zones, or would you say it's just a rougher neighborhood?
Probably just a rough neighborhood.
Okay.
I don't have any problems going into the neighborhoods, but I don't necessarily know I would send my wife there, especially at the middle of the night. I've never been assaulted, attacked. No one's ever even come up to me and give me a hard time.
What attracted you? Was it just that these properties generate a lot of cash flow?
The profit potentials are huge. Very few people either want to deal with the headache or know how to deal with the headache. And so it leaves a very large opportunity to go in and turn the properties around and make a lot of money because people are just dropping them off and dumping them at these incredibly low prices.
So tell me, like, what are we talking? Like, how much do these properties generally cost?
The row houses in Baltimore, you're generally picking them up for less than $30,000 a piece.
And what do they rent for?
Anywhere from $800 to $1,300.
Wow, that's incredible. That really is a lot of property, a lot of profit there. So tell me, like, what are some of the issues that you run into with these properties that maybe you don't see at one of your higher end properties?
Well, you have a couple of issues. One, of course, is getting the tenant to pay.
Mm-hmm.
We have some solutions for that. And the other is just keeping the property up to snuff, having the city come and inspect, maybe a Section 8 tenant, have the Section 8 coming in to inspect and keeping that property on the good side of everybody's inspection portfolio.
So what are some of your tricks that you get to get people to pay you?
Tricks for people paying. Well, first of all, I make sure I do a thorough background check. I obtain copies of everybody's picture ID, social security card. If they have a job because they're a street tenant, then I'm making sure that the job participates in payroll deductions. Basically, it's a voluntary garnishment. The tenant and the employer sign an agreement with me that so long as the tenant is employed by that employer and the tenant is occupying my residence, the employer will pay the rent directly to me. It's not going to be paid. I don't have to chase the tenant down.
Oh, that is really, right, really smart. So you get paid every time they get paid. So if they get paid every other
paycheck.
Friday, that's great. So are you a month ahead then or are they paying in the month that the rent's due?
It depends.
Okay.
For the most part, by the end of the day, we are a month ahead.
Okay. Okay.
Most tenants getting started out, they don't have the cash cushion to be ahead. So we go in and they make a little extra payment out of their paycheck above and beyond what their normal pay should be until we are ahead. And then we drop it down to just the regular month.
Are you able to get that set up with most tenants, or do a lot of them maybe are they not able to do that or don't want to do that?
If they're my tenant, they do it.
Good answer. Good answer. So there's really, that's not negotiable, that they're paying you through payroll deduction or their Section 8 where the government's paying their rent.
That is
right.
Correct.
That's great. Yeah, because a lot of those lower end tenants, from, and I don't have anything to scientifically back this up, but I feel like a lot of them are working on cash or money orders. Like they're not going to be able to write you checks or pay through any kind of automatic deduction. So getting the money from their job, I think is really smart. That's a really, really good move. Now with the being hands-on, like a lot of times with these lower end properties, they say you need to be a more hands-on manager than you would on an upper end property. Is that true? Is there a lot more babying with these tenants?
Absolutely.
Like what kind of stuff comes up? Like what kind of, like how are you being more hands-on?
Well, let's take something simple. You have a HVAC system, gas furnace. You need to change the filter on mm-hmm. a regular basis.
Right.
The tenants have no clue. But you know what? If I don't do it, then that HVAC system isn't going to last as long. It's going
right.
to need more maintenance and higher costs. So we go out there and we demonstrate to the tenant how to change the filter. And if they don't do it, we do it for them and then we'll charge them.
Okay. So how often are you changing the filters? Is it like quarterly or monthly?
They're supposed to change it once a month.
Once, okay. And do you check on that to make sure that they're doing it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So that's just really a hands-on process. Are you calling every month, hey, did you change the filter?
Actually, I'm probably speaking to the tenants more often than once a month.
Okay. So how often are you calling them?
Well, it depends upon the tenant, but it could be a couple times a week.
Okay.
Just to make sure things are going strong.
So
make sure that we have updated contact information, emails, cell phone numbers. That's one of the biggest things that tenants change is their cell phone number, which I'm not sure why, but that seems to be a huge issue with the lower end that they keep changing their numbers.
Right. Okay. Probably because maybe they're not paying the bill. They're having to switch carriers. And so
I don't know.
So you're just, it's really, really intensive. So at the end of the day, with having to be so involved, where with an upper end property, you might go 6 months without talking to your tenants. Is it worth it? Or are you actually netting more money at the end of the day when you factor in your time?
Absolutely. The key though, is you can't do it with just one or two properties. You have to have economy of scale.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
if I had, say, 10 properties, doing this kind of work would just suck up my time and the absolute numbers just wouldn't be there. But with
right.
80 plus properties, you're going to do the work with one person. You have 80 people to do it. You always have something to do and you can just keep on going and use your staff's time efficiently and effectively.
You know, that's a really good point. It's like the more scale you have, it's almost the easier it becomes. Now you have a banking background. That's where you came from. That's your background, and so you're dealing with risk. You understand risk. Do you think that as you get more properties, you get into 80 properties? Do you think there's more risk, or do you think there is actually less risk because you're more diversified?
There is absolutely less risk because you're dividing your risk over a greater number of properties.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So really, like for someone just getting started, would you say it's best to kind of scale up as quickly as you can?
Well, that depends upon the person. I'd hate to tell somebody to scale up when they truly just don't understand the industry.
Yeah, that's true.
Because then you can get yourself in so deep that you implode. The other piece is leverage. You can easily over leverage yourself with something like
right.
this. If you're limited on funds and credit and you don't have a lot of depth as far as free cash flow from any of your other activities, then I might recommend that you take a lower return using a higher end property where it might be safer, less risky.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the cash to either buy outright where you're not overly leveraged, or you have plenty of reserves where you can be leveraged, and if things don't go right up front, you can afford to pay the bill,
right?
Then I would say doing that. The other option is to form partnerships to be part of a larger group.
Sure.
You can
diversify
some of that risk.
Now, tell me about that. Have you bought properties with partners?
Absolutely.
Okay. So how do you generally structure that?
Well, the way I structure my partnerships is because my balance sheet is so strong, I take all the risk.
Okay.
So if we're doing a larger deal, I'm going out and getting the financing with the bank. The only one that's obligated on the bank note is me.
Okay.
All of my partners tend to be, they are limited partners. Their liability is limited solely to the amount of money that they put in.
Okay.
Okay. The way we cover for that and how I benefit from that is I take 10% off the top to compensate me for my additional risk.
Okay. Is that in addition to the property management fee or is the
correct? Well,
okay.
The property management fee is a service that's provided. So
okay.
it's paid out from the LLC and the partnership to the property management company as a fee, just as you would do it for any property
sure.
management company.
Okay. So then you're taking another 10% off for your putting your credit on the line with the property. And then do you split it 50-50 after that?
No. After that, I split it on the prorated portion of the investment. So if I put up 50% of the cash, I'll take 50% of the remaining profits.
Okay.
If I'm putting up 10% of the cash, I'm taking 10% of the remaining profits.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think that's a great way to scale. Having partners, I think, is a really good way to go about it in real estate. Let's talk about insurance. Now, I just bought a property a few months ago, and I had trouble getting insurance. My insurance company that I have all my other policies with, I guess they have a limit that they won't insure properties below a certain dollar amount. Have you had trouble with that, with these lower end properties? That have you found that not every insurance company wants to deal with the lower end properties?
Well, I'm going to guess that you had a problem because you're trying to get a residential property.
That's right.
Residential
That's right.
insurance.
Yep.
So we don't do that, or I don't do that. All the properties are done as a commercial enterprise. They're in LLCs. It's all corporate and commercial. So from the corporate commercial side, you don't have any difficulties with insurance.
Okay. So how is it like a blanket policy that would cover multiple properties, or do you have to get an individual property for each address?
That depends upon the deal and the way the deal is structured. So
okay.
I have LLCs that have one property in it. So that would have just one property insurance. And I have LLCs that have multiple properties, in which case we
okay.
do have blanket insurance.
Okay. Okay. Now, talk to me about turnover. Now, with these lower-end properties, I'm assuming you probably have more turnover than you would in your higher-end properties. Is that right?
Nope. The
okay.
exact opposite.
Really? Okay. Well, talk to me. How do you get people to stay?
Well, because they're actually not paying the bill out of their pocket, or at least they don't think it because it comes out of their paycheck. They have a stable environment, and then the other piece is that we fix the problems in the property. That's probably the biggest piece that impinges on your profits, on the damages that the tenants do that intentionally or unintentionally, or just because they're lazy or they don't know how to take care of the property, properties get damaged. They need to be mm-hmm. repaired and maintained. And we make sure that the properties are well maintained.
Okay.
The tenant calls and there's a leak in the roof. We got a call today from a tenant that there's a leak in the roof. Well, she called at 8:30 in the morning and it's now 11:30. We already have somebody out there taking a look at it.
That's great service.
So,
wow.
By providing that prompt service and that attention to detail and responsiveness, they're happy.
Okay.
We're happy to do it because they're paying the bill on time.
Right.
Because everything comes out of their paycheck and nobody's chasing something. And a lot of times I see landlords say, well, we're not doing this repair until you pay your bill. Well, that's silly.
Right.
It's not how it's supposed to work.
That's good. So you get a good reputation with the tenants and they want to keep living there because you're taking care of them. You're doing the right thing. That's great. Now, what about appreciation? In a lot of these neighborhoods, they don't seem to appreciate as well as maybe an upper class neighborhood. Is that true? Like when you're buying these things, are you not really thinking about appreciation one day?
I'm thinking about appreciation, but the appreciation is zero.
Okay.
Your expectations are for these properties to not appreciate.
Okay. So now what would happen, say, if at some point you don't want to deal with it anymore, maybe you want to do other things with your life, you want to sit on a beach, retire, whatever. Would you feel comfortable hiring a property manager? Like, do you think they would maybe not be as hands-on as you are? Or so if it came time to the point, if you got to the point where you didn't want to manage anymore, would you sell these properties or would you trust a manager?
If you're asking about me personally,
yeah.
Well, nobody works the way I work.
Right.
So
sure.
The answer is no, I'm not going to trust another property management company. My particular goal is to build up enough properties to put them together as a group and sell it as a business.
Okay.
So it's not about the value of the property. It's about the value of the business, the cash flow from the operations, not so much the marketability asset value of the property itself.
Okay.
So I believe I'll need to get to a few hundred properties. I'm on the way to getting there. Once I get to that particular economy of scale, I'll put them all together in a nice, neat little package and sell the business
okay.
as a lump sum.
That's a great exit strategy. That's awesome. Now Baltimore, where you are buying properties, is an interesting city because properties will be like $3,000, and then you go a block and properties are $200,000. Why is that? Like, why do the values change so much so quickly, block to block?
Well, first, you have the condition of the actual house itself. So a property that's $3,000 is probably going to be a shell.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Versus a property that's completely renovated. Now, the second piece is, what are the properties around it like? If you have one property on a block of 40 where 39 properties are boarded up and you're the only property operating, nobody's going to want to live there.
Right.
It's okay. Not worth anything.
Okay.
So okay. That was actually one of my first properties that I bought. Is I bought this one unit, I paid $10,000 for it, and it was actually in pretty good shape, on a block that there were 72 units, of which nobody else was living there. The reason why I bought it is I knew that the city was going to come and tear everything down. Shortly after I bought it, the city came and destroyed every other unit on the block except for mine. So I ended up having a single family house detached. Nobody was around for, a block and a half. And I've had that place tenanted from day one, and everybody loves it. I've only had two tenants in the property over the course of 8 years, and nobody wants to leave.
Wow. Are there plans to redevelop the area?
Well, unfortunately, yes. I actually had that property taken away from me just a couple months ago through eminent domain from the city because they're going to redevelop that area.
Okay.
So I did lose it. I bought it for $10,000. I probably put about $10,000 or $15,000 into it over the course of the past 8 years. The city paid me just under $40,000 for it.
Okay.
And I took $850 a month from a tenant for the entire time.
So okay. So you still did all right. Yeah. Is the city doing anything? Like, are there any like incentives, like tax incentives or cheap financing to go into some of these properties, or are you just basically on your own?
In Baltimore City, there is some incentive for owner occupants, but I'm not buying any of these properties as owner occupant.
So okay.
I'm not able to capture any of that.
Okay.
What we're talking about today is probably not something that anybody's really going to capture.
Sure. Okay. Well, Ken, this was a great interview. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge with our listeners. If anyone wanted to reach out to you or learn more about what you're doing, what's the best way to track you down online?
Send me an email, kenbrown@quasarrealestate.com.
If you missed that, I will go ahead and put a link to your email and also to your website on the website. You can check it out at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode83. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.